Welcome to WGDR Plainfield. This is Undercurrent, and I'm Kevin Patrick. This week, we're going to be discussing peak oil and the end of the fossil fuel age, the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel age. Our guest is going to be Shell Alaklet. He's a professor at the Uppsala University in Sweden. He's also the president of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. So I guess we'd like to start off with just defining what peak oil is and its importance and when the study of peak oil really started to gain in interest.
Yes. Let us start with U.S. Because U.S. has already faced peak oil. Peak oil is when you cannot produce as much oil as the consumers like to have. That means you reach a maximum in the production. That doesn't mean that oil is, it's empty. It's just that the production will be slower.
And so once you hit the peak and start down, it's inevitable that you're going to end up with more expensive oil. And
well, yes, it's a little bit harder to get it out. And the reason is that oil is stored in rocks, you know, and it needs a longer time to float through the rocks to come to the well where you can pump it up. And if you look in the world today, there is around 65 countries that can produce any amount of oil. And out of those 65 countries, already 54 has reached the peak and is on decline, making a short lower production than they did some years back. So there's only 11 countries left that has not peaked in the world.
And most of those are in the Middle East?
Yes, but the next 6 years, so until 2010, your neighbor Mexico will peak, for instance. They have said officially that in 2006 will the production decline, and that means it will be less for you to import, for instance. China is another country that will peak during this period, and their production will go down. So by year 2010, there will be six countries in the world that should support the increase in demand from the whole world and also take care about the decline of all the other countries' production. And those six countries are Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Kuwait, the Emirates, and Kazakhstan, and Bolivia. Iran, for instance, has already peaked. It's on their way down.
And I was reading the ASPO analysis of the World Energy Outlook, and one of the things that stood out was the fact that we were finding very, very few large field oil sites at this point. It's mainly smaller, isolated discoveries.
The bonanza for the oil age was during the 60s. That was the peak in the discovery. Since then, we have found less and less oil fields for each year. And it's kind of interesting. If you look 50 years back, for instance, then the world was consuming 4 billion barrels per year, and the discovery rate at that time was 30 billion barrels per year. Today, we have a consumption rate of 30 billion barrels per year, and we are approaching 4 billion barrels per year in discovery. So we are now taking from the reserves that we have, and the question is in which speed should we use it, and also in which speed can we use it, and that is the big problem. And according to the analysis that we are making, we cannot empty the reserves as fast as we would like to do it, so we will reach a global peak within some years.
I've got another person in the studio with me,
Hi.
Lee Blackwell. I'm going to throw him on the air.
I had a question for you, Professor Alaklet. If you could describe the Rimini Protocol.
Well, we have a choice now, and the choice is if we keep on and increase the demand, that means we need to pay more and more dollars for the barrel and for the oil. And that money will end up in a few countries, you know. And on the other hand, if we try to slow down the consumption, with the same speed as the production slows down, then the heat on the oil market will be less, and we don't need to pay that much money. So the choice is if we don't do that, we cannot afford to do something different either. So we will just put all the money in the Middle East, and we will not have anything at all, for instance, in the U.S. I mean, you still have problem. I mean, already now you have problem with, that you are buying more things than you can afford, really.
I was reading through the outlook, and said in the outlook that since 1988 that real gross domestic product has shadowed oil demand. So by using what we desire for growth rates in gross domestic product, we can kind of get an estimate of how much oil we're going to need if that figure is actually going to be reached. And is it realistic with the current growth projections that we will have enough oil?
I mean, you have something called the Energy Information Administration. That is something that Congress has put up in 1977. And in principle, they have a duty to report what is the future in energy for the American people. But I think they are doing a very bad job, because they are, for instance, saying that in the year 2025, for instance, till that time, we should continue to use more and more oil. And if we add up all the oil that should be used, it's more or less exactly what we have in our reserves for the moment. And those kind of levels is not possible to reach in production, as the U.S. Energy Information Administrations are saying. I think it's very bad for you guys, because you will face big problems in the future.
Do you feel like there's more awareness in Europe in general about this problem among people, not only politicians, but...
I would say that ASPO, the organization I'm president for, is the European organization, and we have been working very hard on these issues for 4 years now, and I think that that's one reason why we might be more aware about these things in Europe than you are in U.S.
Because there's an organization in Europe that's working that hard on it.
Yes.
What about, do you think there's more knowledge and understanding in the general population in Europe?
No, I don't think that, because there is few people that really can understand the dimension of the problems and so on. I mean, there is some correlation you should know about. And that is, for instance, the GDP increase in a developing country, for instance. Take China. When it rises with 10%, for instance, you can say, okay, that's fine, because the people in China can afford to have a better life. But on the other hand, that also means that the increase in the consumption of oil will also be 10%. And as it is now, we have that United States that is 5% of the world population are consuming 25% of all the oil in the world. And China, that is 20% of the world population, they are just consuming 8% of the world production of the oil in the world. And if you ask yourself a question like this, should China be allowed with 20% of the world population to use 20% of the oil in the world? And if you say yes to that question, that automatically means that you must stop using too much oil in the United States.
And China, I guess China's making some moves to solidify their oil supply. They've made connections with Iran, and they're also working with pipelines from Kazakhstan to try to funnel oil eastward as opposed to westward, where the U.S.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
the Western Bloc.
They are doing exactly the same thing that the United States is doing, trying to get support from countries that have oil. I mean, the amount of oil that you are importing every day is enormous, and you must get it from somewhere, you know. United States can never, ever be independent in energy, and that is a fact that I don't think many Americans knew about. That you must have a president that is willing to make the decision that is necessary. And the problem for the president is that he will not be popular. And for instance, if he is in his first term, he will never ever be reelected again. So the president in the second term is the only one that can do something in this matter. And we are set to see if President Bush is brave enough to do the decision that is needed for the American people.
It sounded like you were leading towards this a description of, I think, was it the ASPO that came up with the Rimini Protocol?
Yeah, I mean, that's yes. It started here in Uppsala. Colin Campbell was over here, and we were discussing what to do, because when we say that we have a problem, people are, also ask us, is there any kind of solutions? And then we start to think, and we made up this protocol that in the fall now will be discussed more in detail in Rimini. For instance, when we will get a decline in oil production in the world, you can assume that that will be roughly 3% per year or 2% per year, in that range or something like that. Then the countries that import oil should make an agreement that we should the decline in the import should also then be 2% per year. And of course you need more energy, but then you have to look into what kind of possibilities do you have within the country to get that energy, renewable or nuclear or whatever you think is good for your country. I mean, decisions must be different in different countries, but you must know that if you don't do that, if everyone tries to buy the last drops of oil, those drops will be very expensive, and then you cannot afford anything else.
And in this country, of course, we have a huge untapped source of energy, which is just conservation.
That's right. A very easy thing to do is to say that, hey, everyone that has old cars that takes a lot of gas, if you just turn it in, you will get some kind of some money that you, if you buy a car that are using very little gas, you know, and you switch something that takes a lot of gas to something that is just using a small amount of gas. And such a decision will solve a big fraction of your problem, for instance. And, you know, this is not something very dramatically. It's the percentage per year. And that means that you can prepare. You can make the steps in the right speed, so to speak. But you have to hurry up because it's not much time left.
How much time until a world peak does the ASPO estimate? Do they estimate we've already reached the world peak, or we're very close to getting?
It's very hard to say exactly when we reach the peak, because it's just when we have passed it and we can see that the production is going down that we can say, okay, we reached the peak. But there is a couple of facts now that is kind of scary. There is no spare capacity left in production, and the reason is that the increase in demand is so much faster than anyone had thought it should be. So the new production that will be on stream next year, for instance, is not available to this year, and that is why we have the shortage. Another fact is that all the old oil fields in the world, they are declining with roughly 4% per year. So that means if you have 80 million barrels per day in production today, those fields will next year produce just 77. So you must find a way to fill that gap and also get something more for the increase in the future. And when all those things will not come through, then you have reached the peak.
I read in October OPEC pumped 30.54 billion barrels a day, which is the most it's pumped since December of 79. And according to the IMF, most of the additional output is of a heavier oil type. So, I mean, do those two facts kind of indicate that we're getting close to a peak?
Yeah, I mean, as always, you know, if you have a field of strawberries and you are planning to pick 10 gallons of strawberry or whatever, you choose the nicest first. Who needs to do that? And the smaller one, the one that might not look so good, they are left for the one that will pick the next time. And it's the same with oil. We found so many oil fields in the beginning, so we could choose which one to produce from. Because and of course the companies took the one that was easiest and that has the cleanest and nicest oil. Now we are left with sour oil, as it's called, oil with a lot of sulfur, and many of the refineries cannot take that oil.
Another fact that I came across with reserve replacement rates, most of the major oil companies are reporting very low replacement rates, yes, in the 50 to 60% range, which is another thing. And also that they're doing very little investing in additional refinery capacity, which indicates that they feel that they may have peaked already, but they're really not saying so.
Yeah, I mean, that's one sign. And another thing I used to mention is where the frontier line in exploration is today, and that is out in deep water. There is a field in the Gulf called Crazy Horse. The depth in the meter is 1,844 meter of water. And what they did to find this field was that they had a platform up there on the sea, and they tried to stabilize it with satellite signals and things like that to put it in place. And then they had to put a drill down that deep, and then they drilled for another couple of thousand meters. And then the second thing is, when they have found the field, they should also be able to produce the oil, you know. And this is very tricky and very expensive. So I ask you the question, if the oil companies had any place on ground to drill for oil, you don't think they should have done that first before going out there?
It's very similar to, I've read a statement by Matthew Simmons where he said if these oil companies had fantastic projects that they saw in the future, they'd be out there developing them right now, but they're not. So it's kind of an indication that they know a lot more than they're saying at this point.
And deep water, as this is called, is also said to be the last frontier. And it looks like the discovery from this region has peaked, and that means they will only find smaller fields from now. And that means also that the production will peak in a couple of years. As this is so expensive, they need to pump out the oil as fast as they can. So that means there will be no other fields in the world that will be empty so fast as these fields, the lost fields.
So the fields that the fields that are being discovered now and developed are the more difficult fields to produce and extract.
Yes. And therefore, they had to have a short production because it's too expensive.
I came across a term called the creaming curve, and that has to do with the difficulty of finding oil.
The creaming curve, you have that for regions of fields, and you can also have it for the whole world. The thing is that it's easy to find the big fields first, and that means if you have a choice to try to find the big one or try to find the small one, you go for the big one first. And when you have found those, you go for the next. And that means for each exploration hole that you drill, you will find less and less. And that it means that you get less oil for each exploration well. And this is a curve you get that is shows that you're getting less and less for each year.
And the graph I saw of this curve showed a great increase from about 1963 to 1980, but then it flattened out significantly about 1980.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that since the beginning of the 60s, for each year on average, there has been a decline in the discovery rate. So, I mean, this is nothing that should be surprising, but I guess that they have not dared to tell the truth, and it's just now when they cannot hide it any longer that they start to discuss it.
Right, and this is something that the people of the world, especially the people of the United States, really need to know.
Yes, not only you, but also people in the developing countries. Because if they cannot get oil for increasing their GNP, it will be a very hard time for them. So they need it more than you do, in principle.
So if we're nearing the peak in oil and the production rates are going to drop, especially in relation to the demand, what other, aside from energy efficiency and reduction, what other options are there? I was looking at a few, and how realistic are they, such things such as tar sands and shale oil? And
It's interesting that you mentioned tar sand, because I have had a student that has been working for 6 months now on a project to try to find out what is realistic in production of tar sand. And as a measure, we looked at the decline of the North Sea. I mean, the North Sea is close to Sweden, and the North Sea has peaked and it is on its way down. And so we can estimate how much less we will have in the future. And it turns out that the maximum production from tar sand will not compensate the decline in the North Sea and the decline in the normal oil fields in Canada. So saving the world, no, but it's good for Canada. Another thing that is interesting to see is that if, for instance, the U.S. like to have a lot of oil production from tar sand, then Canada need to use a lot of natural gas to get that stuff into to petrol that you have in your cars. So very soon there will be a choice in U.S. Should we buy natural gas or should we buy gas? And that choice will come.
Shell, were you saying that gas is used in the production or the refining of tar sands?
Well, there is two fractions of tar sand, and the one that is there are most of, you need to soften it up because it is tar that is down there. So what you do, to get one barrel of tar up from the ground, in principle, you boil 3 barrels of water into steam, and you're using natural gas to get that steam, you know.
Right.
And then you send down the steam into the tar, and they're softening it up, and you get it in some kind of floating condition so you can pump it up, and then you get your barrel of tar. You cannot use tar in the car, as you understand. So you must have, and tar has too much carbon in it, so you must have more hydrogen into the thing to get it to gas. So then you take natural gas once again, and then you produce hydrogen from natural gas and put it into the tar, so you finally can get diesel or whatever, you know. And that takes a lot of natural gas. And if there should be a big production of oil from tar sand, then Canada cannot export any natural gas to U.S. any longer.
And, of course, we are heavily invested in the idea that natural gas will be a major player in our production of electricity.
Yes, I think that that is the biggest mistake that the Energy Information Administration has done, that they haven't warned the people of U.S. that natural gas will be a problem in the future.
I think it's 15% of our natural gas comes from Canada, but Canada, that 15% represents 60% of Canada's production of natural gas.
Yeah, something like that. And as I mentioned, they need it themselves, natural gas, and they need it for getting out the tar from the tar sand to get produce gas, you know. So there is another choice for Canada to boil water, and that is to build nuclear power plants. And you boil water with the nuclear power plants and send that steam down to the ground. So then you will have nuclear power for gas, you know.
All of these sources seem like they've really got high energy in, energy out ratios.
Yes.
And an interesting thing about the natural gas issue with Canada, too, that the NAFTA trade agreement could really be a problem in that sense, because according to NAFTA, it it sort of stripped Canada of the ability to keep the natural gas from the, for themselves, so they may have to get out of the NAFTA agreement in order to preserve their own natural gas reservoirs.
That's their problem also, you know. So the only choice now for is that U.S. start to import heavily liquid natural gas from Norway or from the Middle East. And according to what I read, no one likes to have those terminals for liquid natural gas. That's another thing that, yes, we need energy, but no, we don't like to have the stuff around us that is needed to get it.
And I think in addition, the tankers that it would take to transport that natural gas across the ocean have not started to be built, and they're very expensive.
There are some tankers coming on stream and so on, but the amount of gas needed might be more than it's possible to get. Yes, the problem is, you know, if you have a pipe for natural gas into your house, it's very hard to have something different, you know. You cannot send have oil in the line, and it must be gas, you know. And otherwise, you have to switch your heating system completely.
So once we have the infrastructure for natural gas, it becomes problematic.
Natural gas, but not for other stuff, no.
You're listening to WGDR Plainfield 91.1 FM. It's about 1 minute before noon. The show's Undercurrent. I'm Kevin Patrick. I'm here with Lee Blackwell, and we are talking with Shell Alaklet. He's the president of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas and a professor at the Uppsala University in Sweden. And you're in the Department of Radiation, is that correct?
Well, you know, I'm a nuclear scientist, I've been doing a lot of research in nuclear physics, basic nuclear physics. I've been visiting many of the labs in U.S., Berkeley, Oregon, Michigan State, and so on. So I'm quite familiar how it is in U.S.
You were talking about using nuclear energy
to
refine the tar sands.
Exactly. And the U.S. and other countries possibly moving to nuclear energy to fill some kind of void, but uranium itself has a peak supply.
That is a very interesting thing about that. And for many years, there have been developments going on in Japan. And you see, there is an enormous amount of uranium in the seawater, but it's a very low concentration. But if you can have a possibility to do electrolyze seawater, you can get uranium out from the seawater. And they are successful in Japan now. It's more expensive. It's according to someone that had visited them and seen how the things worked, and so it should be four times more expensive than the mines that are in production today. But the fraction, the fuel, is a small fraction when you produce electricity with nuclear, with uranium. And that's one solution for supply of uranium in the future. And another thing is that you don't have the dirty mines, and it's a very clean production of uranium.
Look at some of the other options and how realistic they are to fill a gap, like hydropower and biomass.
The thing is that there is not one solution, and that's something we should say from the beginning. You had to find the right solution for the right time and for the right use, for instance. For instance, if you are going to heat your house, you should not use electricity for that, because electricity is too useful for other things than just heating. You know. So biofuel, for instance, biofuel is perfectly for heating, and you should use that for heating as much as possible. When you have electricity, yes, then nuclear power is very good to use for just producing electricity, In U.S., you have a lot of coal, enormous amount of coal, and 50% of your electricity is produced by coal. And I can't see really that you will stop using that. But you can take care of the waste from burning coal better than you do today, and that's something that you should work on. Wind power, yes. Wind power is also something you can use, and you should use it when it's possible. One can say that there are so many different ways to use and get energy and use energy. But and you should not say that, no, that is not right. But you should look into the possibility for all different kinds of production methods.
So it seems as though we need a national plan, a national design to push this forward. It's not going to be a market-based solution because need a strategy,
right,
so to speak.
And the interesting thing is that U.S. Department of Energy have asked Dr. Robert Hirsch, a very well-known person in energy planning and so on, and asked him, what do we need to do if peak oil comes? And in February now, he handed over the report to the Department of Energy. And what he did, he said that, okay, forget about exactly the time for peak oil, and instead look into what do we need to do to handle the problem. And he figured out that it takes 20 years in some kind of crisis management program to take care of the problems. And we need to start this, and this is not just for the United States, it's for the whole world, you know. And we need to start that program 20 years before we have the peak. And if we do that, yes, then we might be successful. But if we start 10 years before the peak, then we will have at least 10 years with big energy problems. And if we start at the time of the peak, then we will have at least 20 years of energy problems. That is according to this report that Department of Energy just has received. And I think that people in U.S. should discuss this, and especially politicians should discuss it, because things is needed to do just now. Tomorrow it's too late.
Do you, Shell, do you feel like from what you've seen in the DOE and the IEA that there is a realistic understanding of what of the fact that there's actually a crisis about to happen?
And well,
is there any real movement?
It's hard to see from the outside. I mean, I would be very surprised if the people that are employed in these agencies don't know the reality. I mean, if that's not the case, okay, then you really have a problem. But I'm guessing that they are discussing different ways of solutions and so on, and but they don't really like to discuss it openly yet, but there must be those kind of planning. If they're not doing those kind of planning, okay, then you have to replace the guys.
It seems as though Dick Cheney certainly has known about peak for quite a while.
Yes, I mean, people in the oil industry knew it, yes.
He was, as a CEO of Halliburton, I think it was the Petroleum Institute in 1999, he gave a speech that really sort of laid out the whole peak scenario. So that
you just need to read Chapter 8 in the energy policy document that he made for President Bush in the year 2001. It was released in May 2001. There in Chapter 8, he says that the world production of oil, if you look into that in year 2020, roughly 60% of all the oil must come from the Middle East, he says. And that's a huge increase. And we now have a situation that the Energy Information Administration in U.S., they think that all the countries in the Middle East must, on average, double their production to reach this demand. Then I think it's time to ask another question. The only source of income for the people in the Middle East is revenue from the oil industry. And if we empty those resources twice as fast as we are doing now, that means that they will be out of resources to get some income much, much faster. So the question is, who should take care of these people when they cannot get any money for selling oil?
And if the administration does really understand, as it seems as though they do from what they've laid it out, the situation, and yet they still say they're not implying that we need to cut our demand. What are the implications there?
All over the world. So what I'm saying now is not just for U.S., it's for politicians all over the world. They are elected on short terms, normally for 4 years. And that means they must come up with things that people think is good, so they will be re-elected or elected at all. I think that you cannot find one politician in U.S. that will be elected if he said, we need to have $1 per gallon of tax of gas in U.S. Do you think he will be re-elected? The problem is that you must promise something good to be re-elected. But another thing that politicians are very good at, and that is to take care of crisis when crises happen. So, unfortunately, I think that we will not see anything before we really are stepping over the peak oil.
The crisis, you mean?
Yes.
That once we do peak, then we'll start seeing the types of...
Then things will happen. Very dramatic things will happen. And I guess that there will be a lot of decisions made then, because those decisions are definitely needed at that time.
Right.
And once we've reached the peak, which is very soon, it seems, what do you think some of the major impacts will be on areas such as agriculture and medicine and transportation?
The problem, if you take agriculture, for instance, is that fertilizer need natural gas. If you don't have natural gas, you cannot make fertilizer. And that is something that is very important. So we should save natural gas for that reason, to be sure that we have a lot of that in the future. And another thing is that you use a lot of oil for producing the things. You know that on the fields you don't see horses and men swapping around any longer. You see big tractors and they take gas and so on. Someone, I don't know exactly the name now, has made an investigation about how much oil the Americans are eating per year on average. Do you guess how much it is?
I think it's about 11 BTUs per one BTU.
I mean, I'm not talking about the energy that you have in the food, but all the energy that is needed to produce it and put it on the table. And that is roughly 400 gallons.
Per
year.
Per person?
Oh, per person.
Per person and year. That is so much oil everyone is eating per year.
And because I saw the ratio of about 10 to 1 for fossil fuel energy versus the energy that we're gaining from our food, and that doesn't even include transportation and packaging and such things.
So I mean, it's many things had to be changed, and I'm not pessimistic, because I think that we human beings are just very creative, and we can do a lot of great things, but... very often, it need to be a crisis before you can do it. I mean, you can, if you look back in history, you see that many of the great inventions was made during wartime. And I don't like to have a war to have these things happen. But I mean, it shows that when there is a crisis, you can do big things. We will have problems, no doubt about that. But we can solve the things also, because That's the difference between being a human being and being an animal. If we had been animals, it had all been over. But we are not animals. We are human beings, and we can think, and we can plan for other things, and we will do it. So this is, I would say, something that should be great for the young generation. They have a possibility to do new things now, to do great things, to really work for something. I mean, if I had been 20 years now, I should go in to study things that has to do with energy and there will be many great things to do. So, and we can see here in Sweden now that some of the most popular curricula we have now in engineering has to do with energy now.